You know that thing where you get an amazing pair of shoes at a really great price and want to tell everyone about it? Yeah, so do we. Here at Designer Shoe Warehouse, we'll give you something to brag about. Like the latest styles from brands you love, or the trends everyone's obsessing over, or shoes that make you feel like, well, you. So go ahead, show off a little. Find shoes that get you at prices that get your budget. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today. DSW, let us surprise you.
Whoa, okay. This one says you get a free phone if you switch. Hey, this one also says you get a free phone if you switch.
Yeah, they all do, hon.
Huh. The T-Mobile one says their customers had the lowest wireless bills versus the other big guys over the past 5 years. And their latest experience plans have Netflix included, plus a year of DashPass by DoorDash.
Mm-mm-mm. Hang on, let me see that. Oh, yeah, we're switching.
That's what I'm talking about. Do we clap now or...
At T-Mobile, get savings that keep stacking up. That's value you can feel every day. And right now, bring your phone to T-Mobile and we'll give you $400 when you switch.
Savings based on Harris X billing snapshots from Q3 2021 to Q4 2025 compared to average AT&T and Verizon bills. Comparison excludes discounts, credits, and optional charges. $400 with new account on qualifying line. Unlocked device credit ported 90 plus days with device and carrier entirely redemption required. Virtual MasterCard typically takes 14 weeks. No cash access and expires in 6 months. Card issued by Sunrise Banks N.A. Member FDIC. Visit T-Mobile.com.
Nerds. Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for calling the Bombas Comfort Line. Bombas make socks, slippers, tees, and underwear made with the highest quality materials. Press 1 for comfort, 2 for style, 3 for donation.
You chose style. Bombas is styles for whatever you enjoy. You can run in Bombas, lounge in Bombas, dress them up, dress them down, but always give back in Bombas. Because with every item purchased, another is donated. Bombas, comfort worth calling for. Go to bombas.com/audio and use code AUDIO for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com and use code AUDIO.
Welcome to Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, featuring influencers, creatives, and thought leaders in the Twin Cities. And now, here is our host, Steve LeBall.
And welcome. I'm Steve LeBall with Synapse, Think Tank of the Air, and we have a lot to think about today. Three guests with excellent titles and even matching initials. We have Sean Pierce, and take a deep breath so I can get all of our title out, Director of Economic Development and Inclusion Policy for the Mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sean. And Miss Shannon Paul, one of my great heroes from early in my childhood, a comedian, a speaker, and a social instigator.
Hi.
We're going to be instigating in just a minute.
Yes, I'm glad. Everybody should.
So. Everybody should. That's right. Join the crowd. And then Elena Imaretska, the Chief Innovation Officer at Brave New Workshops Creative Outreach.
Wonderful to be here.
Well, did you get to make up your own title?
Yes, of course. Sounds important.
Everyone over there, they just improvise everything.
Almost everything, yeah.
Okay, well, it's funny. We have two people from the comedy sector and one from the mayor's office. So I guess, Sean, you're kind of comic relief.
Apparently. We'll see.
So now, did you make up your title?
I didn't really make up my title. We had some conversation about what works when you're trying to move the private sector into a field that maybe they're not used to.
So they had a committee do it.
No, a committee of a few.
Okay, well, start off, tell me how you got where you are. How did you get to be such a big political operative?
Well, I think of myself as team support, although people tell me not to say that. I'm really from a community, a city where you don't get to choose politics. It's essential for our survival.
Mm.
So I like to say I was born into this. I grew up in a family that was very well knowledgeable, I should say, about what was happening in the world.
And in the know.
In the know, for sure, but also strategy. They were a team of strategists.
Oh,
so that's my bloodline.
So, and then when did Jacob call?
I think it was October or November. No, it's a pleasure to get to work with him. He's one of the few council members that I didn't spend a lot of time with in my previous roles, and really a phenomenal guy, an excellent mayor, and outcome-oriented, which is right along the path of work that I like to do.
Did you work with different wards before you took this job on? Or?
I was in a previous position where I had the really the pleasure of trying to coordinate our work in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, Hennepin and Ramsey County, St. Paul Port Authority, both Minneapolis and St. Paul Chamber, and the McKnight Foundation called the Center City's Competitiveness Initiative. And we were focused on capital investment and job growth and kind of your market challenge areas. Mm-hmm. But I would say I've been working with or sometimes against the city at
right.
any given point over the last 15 or 16 years.
Well, I work against the city, too. I'm from St. Paul.
Uh-oh. We still love you. Well,
and like I said when I met the mayor, it's George Latimer, former mayor of St. Paul, said Minneapolis is my favorite suburb. I don't know if he liked that too much. And Shannon, tell me how you got to be a comedian.
Well, you know, when I grew up in Phoenix and then moved here to the Twin Cities in the mid-90s. And so I was going to college at Metro State, and a good friend of mine that I worked with there when we still were Norwest Bank before it turned into Wells Fargo, oh. he and I used to just go to, if I ever write a book, I have to, in the foreword, I have to thank Michael Libri, because he was my friend and we used to just pal around and we would go to Acme Comedy Company all the time and just watch comedians. And I had had friends before say, you're funny, you should be a comedian, you're funny, you should do this. And I'm like, I'm just a writer, I tell jokes. You know, to my friends, I make them laugh. I'm not a comedian. And we were at Acme one day, and I did that whole spiel again. I'm like, I'm not funny like that. And I just tell stories. And my friend Michael Libby was the one that said, well, what do you think they do? Why don't you just figure out how to make it sound like their jokes? And I was like, and he just articulated it in just the right way. And I was like, okay. And so I went back there, and I was in a comedy writing class at Metro State. And
you studied this in school.
Yeah, and so I was instead of writing what I normally would have done, which was like a one act or, you know, a short story, I was like, okay, I'm going to write a 4-minute set. That's about the length that I would need for the class that I was taking. And I wrote it, and I ended up performing it in our class, and I didn't die. And then I reworked it a little bit, and I went to Acme Comedy Company, and I signed up for their open mic, and I was second on the list, and I got up there and I performed. And when I get nervous, I sweat, so I'm sweating. But I didn't die. Yes. I didn't die, and I was like, okay. And I came back, and I, you know, met some other comedians and got in with a little clique, and, you know, just one thing led to another, and I'm still here. So
you haven't died every week
since? No, exactly, and that's really what it feels like. It's like, yeah. You know, I can still do this, and I've still managed to figure out how to find joy in it, because, you know, in the comedy community, you have some very talented people, some very funny people, but it is not always full of happy people and not always good people. And there is a lot of maneuvering the water in this industry. So I'm just very fortunate that I've managed to make this into a career and just kind of expand on it and be able to do things in the storytelling community, to be able to be a speaker and speak on cultural sensitivity and talk about issues, and to be able to use this platform for other things as well. So I know I'm very fortunate that I get to just kind of pal around and try and use humor to start conversations.
A humble instigator.
Yes. That's why I kind of came up with the title, because I was like redoing my business cards and trying to decide what laundry list of things that I was going to put on this card. And, you know, do you want to put writer? Do you want to put this? And it's like, that's really what I do, is I go around and I try and encourage people to think about things and to talk to one another and to communicate. And so that's my definition of what a social instigator is trying to get people to interact with one another, because not everybody's good at that. And I'm one of those people that thinks everybody is my friend until they prove otherwise.
Okay, so, we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going fine so far.
Yes, exactly.
So, Elena.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Now, you came here from?
Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, you landed in comedy, too. How did that happen? What's your story?
Yeah, well, destiny, perhaps. Yeah, so I grew up in Bulgaria, and it was pretty turbulent times at the time. We were moving from communism and kind of autocratic leadership and the planned economy to a democracy and a market economy. So,
and then what happens?
As you can imagine,
an autocrat again.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. Somewhere on that spectrum, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe we'll talk about that later too. But at the time when I was growing up, it was hyperinflation and pretty turbulent, and it didn't seem like there was a whole lot of hope for the young people of Bulgaria. And so we were really encouraged to seek other ways. So it was, if you can get out, get out.
Right.
And I was very lucky because I earned a scholarship to come study in the U.S. And so at the age of 18, I boarded a plane for the very first time and left the country for the very first time and made the trip to Colorado. So I went and did my undergraduate degree at Colorado College.
Start at the top.
Start at the top, exactly. Just beautiful, magical place, which, of course, changed my life completely. And then right after that, I went straight to grad school, to business school. And while I was there, you know, you do a lot of thinking about your career and what you want to do with your life. And I've always loved the arts and always been involved with dance and theater, a little bit of theater as well. And I started thinking about, okay, how can we fuse arts and business? You know, I'm a big proponent of kind of idea fusion and just learning from different sectors and not reinventing the wheel. And like you, you know, just what can we learn from each other and how can we make things better? And so I did a little bit of research and talked to a lot of people, and someone told me about this little company in Minneapolis. And by the way, I knew nothing about Minneapolis.
You're still in Colorado?
And actually, I was in Arizona then grad school. And the Brave New Workshop, and they were using improvisation to help business professionals be more effective in their jobs.
Oh, okay.
And I thought that was absolutely brilliant, and I wanted to be a part of it. And so my last semester in school, I invited the Brave New Workshop to come and present at this conference. The conference was all about innovation, and so they did. And the grad school I went to is very international, so 50% international students. And when the Brave New Workshop came and they did this phenomenal workshop, and I saw how effective it was to actually use improvisational techniques to teach and to have people practice and think differently and laugh at the same time, I said, okay, that's it. That's what I want to do. And so I contacted the president of the company at the time, and I said, hey, I want to work for you. Yeah. So we interviewed over Skype, and after graduation, I loaded all my life and belongings in a car and drove across the country, and here we are. That was 11 years ago.
Okay, we're all here together, and I think you want me to tie this together, Sean, so I think we need more city support for comedy organizations.
I see.
Comedians. I mean, think if everybody smiles and laughs every day.
Right.
Couldn't that kind of be the butterfly effect that could change our whole mentality of our city?
Well, what I love about comedy and about the arts in general is that there is a truth-telling component, or there at least is an opportunity to tell the truth. And funny enough, right, that's a little bit of our challenge here in the market, in the Twin Cities, in our region overall. We play really nicely together, but we're not often honest about the challenges. We're not often honest about how hard it is to come to this place and then be told, oh, I'm going to invite you over for dinner, and then 10 years later never actually receive that invitation.
Oh, right. You're talking about Minnesota Nice.
I'm talking about Minnesota Ice.
Ice.
Sure. Because I think, you know, from, you know, and Elena, maybe you can speak to this as well. You know, as someone who moved to Minneapolis and, you know, the Twin Cities area, so I didn't meet it.
From Arizona.
And I think, you know, and I travel a lot, and I think what's interesting about this particular community is that it's organically homogenous, because the way that Minnesotans, when they upgrade, they move 2 miles away from where they grew up. And when they travel, and not all of them, and this is changing, you know, and it's even evolved since I moved here in 96, but a lot of the travel is, it's in, the patterns are, I go up north to the cabin, so you still have a similar circle. So you have your circle that you have in your block, in your neighborhood here in the Twin Cities. And then you have, because you usually travel at the same weekend every year, you hang out in the same area. So you have another circle that's your lake circle or your vacation circle that you do. So when people move to this market,
Circle Lake.
Right. You know, you're hanging out in Matamita, you know, you live in Matamita and then you go up to Nisswa, but you go up and you see the same people in Nisswa every year too. So I feel like this circle doesn't expand because they don't need to.
Well, because I think it's even deeper than that. Mm-hmm. So I'm from Chicago, and mm-hmm. where I'm from, we travel together.
Right.
We enjoy each other. We spend time with our families and friends. We, you know, like to meet new people. I don't see the issue in being with your people.
Right.
I think that's actually what makes our communities really strong. I think the issue is that when we find people who are different, we other them.
Right.
So I'm going to mm-hmm. hang out with my people, but if you don't go to my lake, right, and we're talking right. about a very specific group of Minnesotans,
right.
so we should also name that. If you didn't go to my school, if your kids don't go to my kids' daycare, then I don't really have time for you.
And I think what I kind of noticed was it if you had the personality, and I don't think that a lot of people do, of I am going to over-invite myself into your circle so that you can break in, I don't think that that's human, what we normally do.
No, and so it has to be some sort of intentional instigation.
Correct. And so if you are not that kind of person, which I don't believe most people organically are, it is very difficult. And it's not that they don't want to make new friends, it's that they don't have to. Because they have the same friends from high school or sometimes middle school here, and a lot of other regions of the country don't work that way, where you're not as entrenched with the same community from birth to grave as you seem to do here in the Midwest. And I found that really fascinating, where I'm like, your best friend is still your friend from kindergarten?
Yeah,
right, and that's interesting.
You hear a lot of that, and I've worked there for 30 years.
Right, and I think that's fascinating, and I just was not accustomed to that until I moved here. And after I was like, I'm like, oh, that's why they seem
But it's,
so,
you know, that's so interesting. Mm-hmm. So part of my background is I've done economic and community development in this country and in others for mm-hmm. probably about 15, 16 years right now. And what I've found is that characteristic of having a tightly woven community is very, very common in the best places. I don't see that as our mm-hmm. fundamental
right.
challenge. So even when I lived in New York, there were people who, you know, they went to school together, they raised their families together, but they weren't afraid mm-hmm. of venturing outside of what they knew to be true.
So
they
it's
weren't
the difference,
threatened.
Difference between open networks and closed networks.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And if we can have a conversation where we disagree, but I can respect where you're coming from, even if I think it's fatally flawed.
Right.
Right. But I can understand how you can get to that position. Then I think we can have a different conversation about creating a life that welcomes and affirms all of us without accepting ridiculousness, like hateful things.
Right.
I'm not really trying to understand that.
No.
Right. Well, Elena, did you fit well into the Minnesota culture?
You know, I was very fortunate, I think, because I do have that personality which totally over-invites myself.
Yeah.
And
you keep smiling. I've noticed that about
you. Yeah, yes, yes. I mean, I am very interested in people, and I think people are pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And so I approach every interaction with, I'm curious about you, I want to learn. And then also, I'm not afraid to actually invite people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not afraid to make that first step. And I mm-hmm. think oftentimes that's a barrier, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, I am intentional about you know, making sure that I'm part of networks and that I'm, you know, meeting people and I'm, you know, making that effort.
Now, so, are your friends native Minnesotans or are your friends people that have moved here?
Yeah, it's both. It's both. Mm-hmm. But you're right. People who don't have a network here are far more likely to want to meet and connect and make new friends. That makes total sense. But I would say that even the native Minnesotans that I'm friends with are people who are open-minded
yes.
and who
mm-hmm.
are
yes.
curious and interested. And honestly, the people who are not, I'm not that maybe interested in either. I mean,
well,
you know.
That yeah. keeps them close. I mean, that's, you know, Synapse, part of what we do is focus on this. We call it the friendship gap.
Right.
And I found some statistics from research done in 2014 on the racial analysis of social networks. The average white person knows one black person. I think they know one Asian, one Latino.
Dakota,
you know. And then the average black person knows 8 white people, but they don't know any Asians. In the Midwest, 82% of whites only know whites.
Okay.
And then I think for African Americans, it's like 65%. All their friends are African American. And then it's lower for the other groups.
We're counting Chicago in there. Well, it's like there aren't
there. For the Chicagoans.
Right.
But anyway, so it's, and then we've had events. We had an event recently on the friendship gap. And a woman from Ghana said, you know, when they try to get the different African nation, you know, immigrants together, you go in there together, but then the Ghanans hang out with the Ghanans, the Nigerians hang out with the Nigerians. So there's that organic thing. So you need to do something to get them to mix.
Right.
You need a mixer.
You do, yeah. When I first arrived in the States and, you know, I was at a small campus, pretty small campus, pretty small school. And so we had international students, but it wasn't a large population. So that's exactly what happens. If you have a larger population of international students, you have the Chinese students hanging out with the Chinese students, the Germans with the Germans, the Spaniards with and the Indians. But we actually were, because we're so small, we're kind of from all over. And that made it such a tremendous experience because what I learned was, number one, culture totally matters. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, where you grew up, how you grew up, that definitely informs how you see the world. But that's amazing and interesting and creates a really, you know, back to your point, Sean, interesting conversations, interesting discussions, when there is also that trust and that common experience.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And
I feel good. We've gone this far together
here. Yes, so much trust.
Kumbaya moment.
So much trust here.
we're here with that was just now, Elena Imaretska from Bulgaria.
Good job, Steve.
Those words. And we also have Ms. Shannon Paul and Sean Pierce from the mayor's office. Is the mayor going to listen to this?
I have no idea. I'll invite him to.
Okay, well, you already said in the first segment how great he is.
Really great.
Maybe he won't get to the next segment. Tell us what you really want. We'll be back right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back, Synapse Think Tank of the Air. And boy, you know, I was thinking, what's the difference between race and culture anyway?
So, I mean, and Sean, you were going to bring up a point that before we went to break, or while we were in break, about bringing up the differentiating factor between culture and race. Because we do, because cultural circles are things that are based on more than just race. So it can be,
right.
You know, cultures evolve and change over time. They distort, they change, and lots of these things are based on different histories and a commonality. But a lot of times we jump to thinking that culture is based upon what you can see from a visual or a physical standpoint, and we only go to that, when a lot of things are based upon whatever might be a different commonality. And so when I'm speaking on cultural sensitivity, I try and encourage people to go, what cultural circle is core to you? Like, if you were going to get to know me, a thing that would be good to know about Ms. Shannon is that I am a giant geek. I am one of those card-carrying geeks. When you hear about those women that go to sci-fi conventions, dress up, read too many comic books. Right. That's me.
We've got geeks.
Right. Yes, and so knowing that is something that if you look at Sean and I, maybe you wouldn't jump to that particular conclusion if you only judge us based on physical and visual characteristics.
Right.
But knowing that about us would ease the conversation, because geeks have a language. There is a cultural language that we have.
I notice you were touching your elbows to each other.
Yeah, kind of thing, because we can like bond about those things. And there is a different, like, you know, and once you know that, like now we know that about each other, you could feel almost a barrier drop between the two of us.
I'm thinking about how I should have invited you to go to WakandaCon.
Oh, gosh. And I just have an outfit. I was considering going as Wakandan royalty for Halloween, because I do encourage people, because we are getting ready to go into Halloween. I don't like people to appropriate characters, but I do think that you can show homage to a world. So if you have a child that's really into Moana, there are ways that you can appropriately have them think this is a great character. If you have, you know, friends that are really into Black Panther, because we brought up Wakanda Forever, there are ways that you can be part of that world and show homage to it without appropriating that culture and that character. And I think that there are fun ways to do it. Like, I'm a big fan, you know, I like Harry Potter, and I have a Professor McGonagall hat. I wouldn't dress as Professor McGonagall, but I would call myself a Hogwarts wizard, and I would have a wand. And I think that there are ways that we can still go, this is how we show this, and how we go, yeah, it's neat. I do think people should go, I think Black Panther is a great character, but, and it's a great love letter to Afrofuturism and all of this amazingness. And so I want it to be available for everyone. And so, but I also don't want, you know, my Caucasian friends dressed up in blackface because they think it's okay because they want to be.
Don't do it.
No, that would be cultural appropriation.
Right.
And that might be some other things.
Right. But there are ways that you can go, but no, I get it. And here's how I would transfer this character. Absolutely. And I can show why it's neat. And I want that to happen.
Absolutely.
You know, well, I don't want it to be only for us by us when we have this amazing property out there.
On the opposite end of it, there are people that only see color. And like, I'm thinking of a corporate office. Mm-hmm. We need diversity. Okay, let's get a person that, you know, a black person, an Asian person, you know, go down that line. But then we want them to think like us.
Right.
So then you have the opposite. You have, you know, the you don't have the diversity of thought.
Mm-hmm. But I don't want people to say they don't see color either, because I feel like that devalues that, you know, and it devalues that there is a differentiating factor in all of our stories. So you kind of need to be able to see everything. And then, but then not jump to the conclusion that just because we seem physically or visually similar that we have the same story, and getting back to, which was the hard part and part of what, you know, we started in the first segment, is that's the difficult part, is getting to know people on an individual basis
and
as human beings.
Sit down and
I think
talk.
I think it comes down to some cultural agility.
Mm-hmm.
And I always kind of make this comparison that there are white people. Mm-hmm. And then there are people of European heritage, mm-hmm. and then there are people who are light-skinned, mm-hmm. like somewhere on that spectrum. And whiteness is a very particular culture, right? Mm-hmm. And some of it is about not having a culture anymore, right?
I think there's a lot of white people jealous of everybody.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. and that's how appropriation starts, when you have this longing for a connection.
Do you get out of this, Elena? Because you're not a white American. So Bulgarians, they have a culture, don't they?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, but I think
we all have a culture.
Everyone has a culture. Yeah, exactly. No, this is really interesting discussion for me, because, you know, I'm an immigrant, right? But I think I'm treated differently than other immigrants because I'm white, because I have certain education, because I came to study, you know, so that's a very interesting mm-hmm. and important factor mm-hmm. to consider. But this whole question of whiteness, it's very interesting, again, because I have a friend who is from Turkey. She's an immigrant as well, and she's Caucasian, but she doesn't consider herself white.
Right. Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm.
This is very common.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Amongst immigrants who get classified or choose to classify as white.
So light skinned,
but
the white has a cultural component to it.
Well, let's go deeper here, right?
Okay.
So I always say, you know, people go, oh, we need to have a black person at the table. That's great. Mm-hmm. Let's not pretend that I have the same perspective as a black person who is born and raised in the United States, who believes that capitalism will save us,
mm-hmm.
because I don't share that perspective, right? I wouldn't consider myself a part of the black elite. The culture that I'm from, the culture of my family, the culture of my community, is one that prioritizes family and not titles, because titles don't change and haven't changed the conditions of black people, many of whom are descendants of slaves in this country. So there's a unique culture within our racial categories. Where it gets tricky is when I think people who get to exercise and live amongst white privilege start exercising culture as a way of claiming things like reverse discrimination or saying things like, oh, but I have this experience too. It's like, no, you don't. I think what you're saying, Elena, right, of having that privilege that is given to you before people even get to know you, that's real, mm-hmm. right? So this thing that happens that can be very simple of getting on a bus and a bus driver responding to each of us differently, that isn't really a cultural response. That's a racialized response, right? And we're all on the bus. So there's even that assumption around class or around access, but even within perceived similar categories, we're treated differently. So there's that reality. But then I think there is the possibility that if people who identified as white actually learn their heritage, then we would be in a much better place, because it gives us a linkage to understand the types of culture that we grow up in. So I, being from the south side of Chicago, I know what it means to be black in the United States, right? I know what it means that my mother is of the age and is a part of the group of people who had dogs let loose on them and water hoses turned on to, on them in the street. And by the way, that's actually happened in our lifetimes.
Right.
I know what it means to still work with the kids who had to deal with nooses being hung from the trees or who are being kicked out of schools, or six-year-olds in our very own city and in our very own region who are being told that they're going to be deported because they're immigrants. Like, I know with black immigrants, by the way, because we also talk about immigration as though it's like solely one group.
Right.
Like, I know what that means. But that is a very different racialized reality than the culture that I grew up in, where the aldermen, the teachers, the principals, the firefighters, the people at the grocery store, and everywhere else were actually black. And so I have the opportunity to understand that while we might be geeks, that's a unique subculture,
right,
within our racialized experience and in our location of origin, mm-hmm, speaks differently. So my experience, I always kind of say Minnesota is like a different Midwest. I don't know what happens when you cross Milwaukee, but it's a whole other place.
And since Sean grew up in the Midwest and in Chicago, I grew up in in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. So my background of growing up in Arizona, which has kind of like closer to a southern mentality without the cool accent, and
fried chicken.
Yeah, you know, and I grew up in a neighborhood, you know, and I tell people, like, you know, and so much of what I say is, of course, like, you know, comes from how can I make light of this? I say I'm hood, I'm not ghetto, you know, kind of thing. So I didn't grow up in a great neighborhood, but my mother was very conscious of here is how you will be educated, and here is how you will speak, and here is how you would be. And my mother got a job at a private Christian grade school, so my sisters and I would go there. And it wasn't the school in our neighborhood. And so she worked to say that we will not only be this particular neighborhood that we went in, you know, but that doesn't change the fact that my experience was, you know, I remember growing up and being on public assistance, and when we were, you know, and then going from this small Christian grade school to an inner city high school, and then always feeling like a lot of my life lessons were, well, I'm not black enough for the black kids, and I'm clearly not white. So thank gosh I'm a geek. I'm just going to hang out with the geeks over here anyway. So I was able to find my circle and figure out that I was okay.
Culture,
right, exactly. Because I was like, okay, I was able to figure out, okay, well, where can I find people that are most like-minded to me? And it ended up being something different than, again, the visual or the physical. But the storyline still remains in when I'm making my my thought patterns. I don't distance from the fact that I happen to be a black female American, you know, and so a lot of my foundational story and, you know, starts there. And so when I make it, may filter through additional pots as I'm going, but a lot of my perspective still comes from, no, you know, this is, I might be, you know, and Sean, maybe you get this too. I get the nice version of, well, you're okay because you're one of the good ones. I get the nice version of that,
right,
where, don't worry.
I'm glad you get the nice version.
Yeah, I get the. Well, you're in media, so you'll always be fine. You'll have this, and I'm like, well, we don't live in that world. We don't live in any world where anybody is overtly safe or precious or not looked at like you're still one of the others when that thing happens.
But that's such an important concept, because there is the reality of exceptionalism, and I think that's a part of what happens within the communities of people of color. Certainly within a black community, where so many of us have been in this country and have been the only black people in a room,
right?
So there's that exception, you know, to the rule. And then people start to think that, oh, if I get this title, if I get a promotion, if I get this access, then I'm somehow better. And I like to tell, my colleagues in the office, and I tell people in general, I don't care what my title is or how much I make. If I don't do something to make the world a better place and to make my people and my community stronger and better, than I will have failed.
Right?
Like, we don't get ahead when we as individuals, no matter your race or your ethnicity or your culture, as individuals, we simply are losing by being so individualistic.
Yeah. And I do occasionally feel as though it's almost held against the group. I feel like the prevailing culture, if they see one of us that is doing well, then they go, well, see, that one's fine. So I no longer have to do anything else. I don't have to take action. I don't have to feel bad. And then we're washed away. And I'll use up an example. You guys may not have seen this yet, but I just had the opportunity to see the film The Green Book, which is coming out. So it's Viggo Mortensen and Mahershala Ali, who I enjoy. And I appreciate Mahershala Ali. I appreciate the work. Mm-hmm. And I really like that it back to because I enjoy starting conversations, and I think that this movie will do a wealth of starting conversation. But I happened to be in a screening where they had a panel afterwards, and the part where I was sitting there, and I happened to be next to, you know, one of my African American friends, you know, then, so we were kind of like poking each other because we liked 90% of the movie, but then it Disney-fied racism and what was going on in the South and the way that they have the story, because everything is resolved by Christmas. Mm. And that's when I don't think every movie needs to be 12 Years a Slave. Everything doesn't have to punch you in the gut, but I don't think that it should be. And this is where I really was kind of like, because during the discussion, there were people that were talking to director. And again, remind you, I do think that it is a good movie, and it's, you know, if it is used to start a conversation, but there were people who were going, I felt so uplifted, and I felt, I'm so glad you made this movie, and you know, and my questions are, well, that's fine, but I do think that we do have some additional change that needs to happen, and if people feel better already, I don't think that that's enough. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like, well, I don't want people to be able to come out of this film feeling, you know, okay, everything was fine because I saw that movie.
Part of the problem of movies is that becomes your experience. I mean, how many times have you heard someone in a terrific situation where there was a tornado or something fierce, and they say, it was like in a movie.
Right.
Like I was in a movie, as if that's higher than reality. But it's a substitute for reality for people that don't have any other experience. If you don't have any black friends, your image of black people is what you see in the movie.
Right.
So here's the thing, Steve.
Yeah.
I believe that race is a cover for something much deeper. And there are too many people in this state who will say they've never seen black people to like be able to live there, right? It just doesn't add up.
Never seen it? You mean like colorblind or just not seen?
Let me tell you, I think it's such a lie, I don't even bother to ask them what they mean when they say it, because it's irrelevant. It's factually not true. You either never watched TV, never looked at a magazine, or you've completely isolated yourself.
This metropolitan statistical area does not lend to that answer and that response.
Right, it just doesn't make sense. But I think that the underlying piece that perhaps the dominant system, it's just beyond race, doesn't want us to get at is what's happening around class, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's part of the bigger theory of the oppressive system.
Absolutely.
And then race is a tool to divide and conquer.
Absolutely. Right. So the commonality amongst all four of us, is that at some point the places that we've been, if not now, have been through a class-based upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
And in that movie, and in Wakanda, well, I mean Black Panther, but I call it Wakanda, right?
The homeland.
Well, you know, it's somebody's homeland. Right. I love the technological aspects of it, but what we saw in the film, and if you remember the film Crash from back in the day, it was not really back in the day, but you know, this was
back in your day.
Back in somebody's day. what we saw is a grappling of a clash of cultures really based in class-based differences. And then we saw actually the people, almost always, the people of the ruling class, the owning class, actually are always the saviors.
Right.
Now, sometimes they happen to follow a racial line.
There's a movie. Right. Elena.
Yes.
What do you think? I mean, you didn't have, I assume it was fairly homogenous in Bulgaria.
Yeah, fairly homogenous. And so that's why for me, it's been a really interesting journey to come here and learn about all of this. And to be honest with you, I'm still learning and I feel very, very lost at times. I mean, honestly, even being here with you, having these conversations, I'm just listening and I just want to know what's going on because it's so complicated. Mm-hmm. It is so complicated. And it's uncomfortable to be in that ambiguous place where you don't really know what's going on. And I think that's why people don't want to have the conversations.
Right.
Because as humans, we don't want to be uncomfortable, right? But we have to be. Because to a point that Sean was making, we all have to have the mindset of how do we make things better? How can we serve? How can we solve for the so many challenges that we have, not only in this community, but in this country, in the world? I mean, if we don't think of ourselves as problem solvers, as innovators, as instigators, as connectors, and as learners, you know, there's no hope, right? And so I think that's a huge mindset shift that has to happen for everyone. And you all clearly have that. But it has to be everybody. Absolutely. Everybody.
Well, I think your experience and that you started to describe of being in and then leaving Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the way you started to talk about what was happening there, I immediately flashed back to East St. Louis and the schools that have been flooded with sewage since forever. Mm-hmm. The Detroit scenario with them not getting water and what that meant. Right, Alabama and people living with septic systems that are backing up to their homes and there's no sense of care and like the economic collapse that is taking place in all of those. And so it's like, I think that, again, we get distracted by race and now we need to triage race because it's been so embedded in our policies and practices. But on a personal level, to know and experience what it was like to be in a home that was being ripped from you based on economics and based off of a decision that a majority of the people didn't matter, is that's like, that is the experience of many, many people in this country.
And you're right. It's all about economics. You know, I do believe that it's all about, always all about economics. So we have to address that. You know, it was interesting. So my husband is from Danish descent. And so we went to Denmark, you know, a few years back and we talked about that, you know, so what do the Danes consider being the principles of their culture? And one of the things, which has been for many, many years, hundreds of years, is that we're only as good as the people who are sort of last. You know, so we have to take care of everyone for us all to prosper. And I think that it's not necessarily the case people think in this country because of certain myths that people believe, that honestly I believed. You know, coming here and having a view of what the U.S. is or was, and now being here for 11 years, you know, I start to see things differently.
Do you feel comfortable saying what some of those are? Some of those beliefs that either you heard or that you had?
Yeah, the big one is the, you know, pull yourselves up by your bootstraps. I think that's a huge one because I don't think that's the truth. You know, I think there is a lot of need for people to be innovative and driven and motivated, etc. But the truth is, we have only a certain amount of energy, number one, and we can only think about the things that are around us. Who we're surrounded by, the realities that we're surrounded by, that really affects how we think. So sometimes you can't even think of a different solution because of what you are. And then there are some systemic things.
Well, we'll think of a solution when we come back because we have, boy, talk about a think tank. It's this thick. You know, I thought we'd be talking comedy and all that stuff. We're talking reality.
Well, you know, sometimes reality can be
comedy. You can't have comedy without reality.
Okay, right? We'll be back to reality right after this.
Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. We'll be back in a moment.
And we're back with Synapse, Think Tank of the Air. I'm Steve LeBeau, and we have Sean Pierce from the mayor's office and someone that's grabbing political realities with both hands and who knows what else?
And some rope, some lube.
Hands and ropes, whatever you can grab. And we have Miss Shannon Paul, who makes her living making people laugh, but also by reaching into their gut, kind of.
Well,
take a look at this.
Well, I mean, honestly, I mean, that's what I do as a speaker, is I do talk on cultural sensitivity, and I am not a professor. I'm a person who's had a number of different jobs and navigated, you know, the professional world and now, you know, travel a lot with comedy. And so I spend a lot of time studying human beings. And
right, because that's the most funny thing at all.
Yeah, and I mean,
and tragic.
But that's the point, is balancing those things. And so when I am doing, when I'm speaking on cultural sensitivity, I do speak on it also from a position of humor and trying to use that as inroads to start this conversation. So if you can't take my velvet glove, then somebody needs to slap you with a hammer. You know, that's just reality.
Humor has long been the secret weapon, because you can say anything with humor and get it through. But if you say it straight, or you know, even with a kind of a negative tone, then it's harder to accept.
Right.
And we're also here with Elena Imaretska, who works in the field of humor. And I think you must pick up some of that over at the Brave New Workshop.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way we use laughter is actually as a way to build trust and to help people become more comfortable being uncomfortable.
So people need to laugh together.
They mm-hmm. do need to laugh together, exactly. Because improv is funny, not because there are some jokes or because it's crafted, but it's because it's people who are imperfect creating something out of nothing together, and they actually are collaborating and they're building on each other's ideas, and they create something unexpected. And it's something that's unique, and it happens just in that space and just in that room.
You can
see
it
happen.
And
that's what's special about it. Yeah, and that's what's special about it. And what we do actually in our work is we help people who are not improvisers, who are not performers, who are actually professionals, very successful people. We help them become more vulnerable and try something that they've never tried before together.
It changes your mind.
It does change your mm-hmm. mind, and it helps you think differently, and it helps you connect with people, and it helps you practice being uncomfortable and still moving forward. And that's perhaps the most important thing that we should teach everyone how to do. Mm.
I learned how to be uncomfortable because I got married.
Yes.
But I got married to a Japanese woman who is from Japan, and then all of a sudden came here and went to school in Chicago and said, all of a sudden I was a minority. Mm-hmm. What is this? And absolutely. So then she opened her eyes to that. And then since we've been married, she's opened my eyes, because white people are so oblivious because they don't get to see these things, a lot of things. So we'll watch TV, and she'll say, that's racist. And I'll say, I don't get it. I don't think it's racist. A half hour later, it's like, oh, now I get it. Mm-hmm. So now I'm up to only 3 minutes. I can spot it. You know, the conversations are shorter. But there are instances with her where I've run point blank into terrible racism that I've seen because I'm white. Mm-hmm. How people are giving her resistance, but then when I walk in, it changes totally.
Absolutely.
Right.
So I think those experiences are very valuable. Most people don't get to have them, most white people.
Yeah, and that's why traveling is so important. And just getting out of, you know, an environment that's comfortable and safe, because that's when you start seeing things. That's when your mind opens. And that's when it becomes fun, honestly.
Right.
You know, it was really
maybe they can go to they can go to Wakanda.
I wish we could go to Wakanda.
Take me with you, please.
I think I would struggle in Wakanda.
Why?
I think that I would struggle in Wakanda because there were too many people there who saw people who looked like them struggling and didn't care to actually change it.
Fair
too
enough.
Many people in power.
Right. Who made the decision. They made that decision of isolationism.
Right.
And but at the end, they changed that, right?
Well, but at the end, they opted for charity. So they didn't really change it, right? Well, so Killmonger was really proposing
Sean,
an overhaul.
This is your turf. You'd go in there and change it totally, right? This is part of your job.
You know, that's a huge question. And funny enough, I ended up in a conversation about this the other day. I think we have a choice to make. We can work at changing the minds and hearts of people who don't really care, don't get it, and spend all of our energy doing that. That's a small percentage of people. Or we could spend our energy resourcing people, places, and things that get it and have been ignored and shut down. I believe that it is my role to do the latter. And where there are systemic barriers, to address the systemic barriers. But I'm less concerned with changing something that was never meant. It was never meant to actually serve the people into something that now does.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I can give you several.
Because all that's so abstract.
Well, really basic things, the way permitting has happened in the country, or redlining, right? Mm-hmm. So the system around housing.
I've talked to white people that don't know what redlining is.
Simple version.
It's
pull out a map of an area, and you draw a red line around the area that you deem as less valuable You can, if you if you're the city of Minneapolis back years ago, then that might be called the Negro slum, right? And then the financial institutions align with that analysis, and you underfund and under-resource in that area.
It's too risky to make an investment.
It's right. Not only is it too risky to make an investment, but what you do then is you systematically push all of the people of color or the poor people. In this case, for our city, it was the blacks and the Jews. You push them to that area where now you don't have the infrastructure. You don't have the investment in even the housing stock. You don't get permits for businesses, so people can't legally sustain or have the amenities they are required and are actually prevalent in the rest
and
of the city.
And these were the way that the laws were stated initially, and then we had to break them apart so that...
Well, we really haven't.
Well, technically...
So we're still working at it, huh?
Yeah, and there's a good... If they want a Cliff's Notes version of what Sean just said, there is an episode of Explained... on Netflix and explained.
You get all your references from movies and TV.
Pop culture. A lot.
Pop culture is important. And pop culture.
Maybe
and
that's a geek thing.
Yeah. But there are so many things. And I think that a lot of filmmakers and people who were working on these big budget things and things now, because they do have passions and projects and opinions, and they are now using their platform that too. So you do see the way that these things are happening. So there are a lot of independent films and documentaries and things that people who were working on Star Wars, and now they're going to do this film about the black urban cowboys in Compton, in Los Angeles, and the fact that there was up on this hill, there used to be a stable where these people would, instead of being gangbangers, would keep their horses. Or you'll hear these stories in Explain where they will explain redlining because it was a story that people weren't being told.
So instead of using humor to convey these things, they can use art.
Right.
And well, you can. And art is easier to understand. And I think that right now, my push for all of our producers and our writers and our creators is to stop just reflecting and actually start changing. So if you take something like redlining, if you eliminate the policies and the restrictive covenants that have run with the land, and if you do all of that, you then have to actually deal with the fact that you have businesses who've never gained the capacity to do what an institution that has been around for 100 years has been able to do. You have to deal with the fact that you have families, primarily black and indigenous families, who have never been allowed to own a home. And you have to deal with the fact that you have a brokerage system, that will still allow the homeowners to do things like tell a black potential buyer that the home is no longer on the market and therefore they don't need to look. And then as soon as they leave, it's back on the market. So we could spend all of our time trying to change that. And from a policy standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to. But I don't think that it makes sense to go and try to campaign people and change their minds. Just change the law. Right.
So you're for changing the law rather than changing people's minds.
I think that you start by changing. If people can't, we know the history of this country. We know the history of the country in terms of how it's treated indigenous people. We know the history of the country and how it's treated black people. We know the history of the country and how it took land from the Mexicans. We know the flexibility of immigration policy.
But I would argue that we've changed laws and now we're losing them. The Voting Rights Act and things, some of those are going backwards.
Because we didn't change the law. We made accommodations, like the Voting Rights Act. I mean, we had so many things that had to be renewed by Congress. They weren't changed. They were tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't erased. So that's my whole point.
They're tweaked off the shelf. And so,
it doesn't make sense to tweak something that is at its base, racist, classist, homophobic, or ableist. It does not make sense. Erase it. You have to eliminate it in order to actually build something that is just, which, by the way, we all benefit from.
But I think that there is a part of the prevailing culture that likes to continue to do those tweaks, because then when you don't remain diligent, then they can roll back those tweaks.
That's the
trick, is they go, okay, and they do it as a pacifying measure. They encourage you to be reasonable. And then there are so many people on this side that we keep going, yeah, we know we should be reasonable. We're not going to keep shouting. We're going to be reasonable. But then eventually your reasonable nature is used against you.
But here's the deal.
If
in the United States, if the Japanese, when they were interned, continued to be reasonable, they eventually would have been slaves.
Right.
right?
So you have to not be reasonable.
Right, and I think this thing about what's legal isn't the guide.
If the law is bad, you have to be unreasonable.
Erase it, eliminate it.
But getting back to your point, I agree that you have to change the laws, but you also have to change the attitudes, otherwise they'll be, you know, pulled back.
Right? I think that you do, right. But we very often prioritize the changing of attitudes, and that takes exponentially longer. So if we look at over a 3-year time span, the change.
Well, if we have a comedy initiative,
right,
and get some good movies and TV shows,
right. Well, but then you have to watch TV and you have to go to the comedy show,
right.
and to Elena's point earlier, right, not everybody has the time,
right.
So if I don't have time to go to that comedy show and I don't have time to watch TV or I can't afford television, how am I going to interact with that? What I'm interacting with is the environment around me that's interacting with me.
And
so
you
have to change the environment.
And they like to have a safety net that is already something they are accustomed to.
Absolutely.
So if you sit there and go, if you give them the ability to fall back on an outdated way of thinking and law and go, well, I know that seems outdated, but it's still there.
Or it's too fast.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's too fast.
That's the false.
You have to just start saying, I want it today, which I know is unreasonable. But if I keep saying, I know that things take time to change and evolve, then you'll continue to have us wait.
Yeah. We've been a few hundred years into some of these things. Right. I don't know how much more time
people
need.
And that's the point, is that you have to create discomfort because
absolutely
they're too comfortable.
Well, and it's a breaking open.
Elena, why don't you join in here?
Yeah, I'm really curious what you guys think about this. Almost reframing a little bit and thinking about how can you talk about and give the stories of the positive outcomes that are possible. Mm-hmm. And so I loved your point about artists and media folks should actually be creating the vision, not just reflecting, but also creating the vision of what's possible, because people are motivated by fear. But when people are fearful, they tend to fight or freeze.
Absolutely.
So we have to motivate people by vision and by excitement and by positive movement. And that's when things get exciting, and that's when things actually truly can change. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of, kind of social enterprises and, companies and organizations and businesses that are using the power of business to create change when they think about the impacts of the business and really thinking about all the stakeholders and all the impacts that are happening. And a great example of that is the Grameen Bank, which has been, around for so many years and does microfinance. So they did the exact opposite of what those financial institutions that you were talking about. They actually went to the people who didn't have the resources for collateral, but they lended not to individuals, but to groups. And they went to their doorstep. And they are so successful. They're a successful business. And I saw the founder of the Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus, speak a few years back, and he said, there's always a solution and there's always a business model that can be built around any social challenge.
Absolutely.
And to me, that's so hopeful and exciting. And I think that's why we have to challenge ourselves to think differently all the time. Is there a different angle? Is there something else we can be doing to solve?
Mm-hmm. Well, and the beauty of what they did was that they broke open. So they didn't say, okay, this is what the market says, this is how all the other banks have done it. And I think some of our most innovative firms and innovative moments come from that point where we say, we don't have to be like others in order to be successful.
Yes. And that's scary. That can be scary, right? So again, we're back to, we need to learn how to be uncomfortable, right?
Absolutely.
And actually, that's part of improv. I mean, to be able to jump into the unknown, the void, and have enough confidence. Because your brain has changed, you can innovate. And I think that's a big problem. I mean, people that can't innovate, cannot change, cannot learn. I think there's your attitudinal problem, right? They're stuck.
Right. But I think that we've kind of, when you're talking about how do we get these voices to be more outspoken, I don't think that we always champion, and we should, when people are starting to speak up, we go, okay, as an artist, you're not supposed to have an opinion. You're just supposed to do this. Or how dare you as an actor, how dare you as this have an opinion? You're going to lose all of your fan base. You're going to this. And so we don't encourage people to go, no, stand up and use your platform. And then we have movements like, and I, whenever I see the word self-care, I get crabby. Because because self-care became such a big deal.
Right. Because when
self-care really started to be put to the forefront is when things did start to get uncomfortable and the news made people mad and upset. And instead of going, yes, go out and do something to change and be involved, we said, it hurts too much. Maybe you should put a mask on your face and stop reading the news. And, you know, and so instead of dealing with these emotions, and that's a very Midwestern thing too, we go, cram them down and feel better. What can I do to immediately feel better? And instead of going, no, you should stay involved. And I'm not saying that you should stay up scrolling through news headlines at 2 a.m. in the morning. But if you see something, then maybe you should become involved instead of just going, well, how can I put cucumber slices on my face and stop feeling bad instead of doing something?
That's right.
So I'm like, whenever somebody brings up self-care, I get mad because that means you just thickened your bubble instead of, I'm like, okay, you need to activate people as well.
Yeah, I think I do believe it's a balance,
yes.
Right? Because there are some of us who don't get to practice self-care.
Mm-hmm.
were you looking at my phone at the time when I was
there? No. Well, but I hate to interrupt, but we're almost out of time.
Mm-hmm.
This is such a good conversation. We should probably just take over bolt the door in the studio and just keep talking. But what makes me hopeful, I mean, I'd like the variety of people in multiple ways. For example, I'm glad there are accountants because I would never want to do that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's good to have a variety of people. And then to have a variety of people with some common sense that we're all in this together.
Right.
And I'm so glad, Sean, you're working on the political end because I actually, worked in government for 4 years. It made me so cynical. I hate, my sense of pride in American politics went way down the more I saw.
It's
but to stick in there and keep fighting.
I love it. And I kind of joke now. People are like, oh, how's it working for the city? And I was like, it's easier to work in the city. your leadership does matter. Your leadership really, really matters. And without talking about all of the, different mayors or heads of state I've worked with, I have to say that Mayor Fry in particular and his focus on outcomes makes a difference, and he's not malicious. And we have a lot of malicious and ill-intentioned and self-centered leaders. And when I see it, whether it's housing or policing and community relations or economic inclusion, which is what I focus on, he really is thinking about the connection, and he is technically knowledgeable. I mean, to someone that doesn't
that's ambiguous. He's technically knowledgeable.
I mean, so people make policies all of the time.
He's knowledgeable about the technology of it.
I mean, people make policies all the time based off of their feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
He knows how to bring together the emotion with the reality and think creatively toward an outcome.
That's practical. That's that improv? Wonderful.
That is improv. And actually, it's funny. So tonight, I'm leading an improv and design thinking session for the city of Minnetonka. I'm a resident of the city.
I'm going to come out there.
I actually ran for city council in the spring, and I didn't win, but I'm staying engaged because that's my self-care. Is staying engaged.
The political geekness.
Perfect.
Let me know for your next campaign.
For sure. Oh. Yes. Yeah. Oh. Okay. Okay. It might be coming up.
And, as we're saying goodbye, Shannon, you can be heard elsewhere.
Oh, yes. So I do host a show on My Talk 107.1. I host a show called The Mom Show, where we basically talk. Lots of great information that you may have wanted to Google for your family and you got too busy. So we float through that. And I also have my own podcast. It's called Be Our Geek. So I invite all of you to be on it because we do talk about pop culture topics through our geek filters. But then we also have a guest geek on that they geek out about whatever they are passionate about. So it can be a little bit of anything.
Well, I don't know if you do etymologies back to our Indo-European history.
That would be fascinating.
That's my geekness.
Okay, see, we have three shows already planned between you three. I'm good.
Right. Okay, well, I feel so productive today. And let's see. Well, I think I said goodbye to everyone. Elena Imoretska, you're probably be back in politics soon. And Shannon and Sean, it's so great to have you on here. And,
thank you.
And we'll have to get back together again because I think there's a chemistry here.
I think so. I want to be your best friend.
Oh, perfect.
Yes, we'll do.
Okay,
both of
we're
you.
Making friends today. Thanks for listening to Synapse Think Tank of the Air. And thanks to Dan Culhane and Dan Cook for making sure it gets on the air and posted on the website. And also WCCO is our media partner, co-producing this program. I'm Steve LeBeau. We'll be back again next week.
Thank you for listening to Synapse. Think Tank of the Air. I'm Leo Espinosa.
Okay, this one says you get a free phone if you switch. Hey, this one also says you get a free phone if you switch.
Yeah, they all do, hon.
Huh, the T-Mobile one says their customers had the lowest wireless bills versus the other big guys over the past 5 years. And their latest experience plans have Netflix included, plus a year of Dash Pass by DoorDash.
Hang on, let me see that. Oh yeah, we're switching.
That's what I'm talking about. Do we clap now or...
At T-Mobile, get savings that keep stacking up. That's value you can feel every day. And right now, bring your phone to T-Mobile and we'll give you $400 when you switch.
Savings based on Harris X billing snapshots from Q3 2021 to Q4 2025 compared to average AT&T and Verizon bills. Comparison excludes discounts, credits, and optional charges. $400 with new account on qualifying line. Unlocked device credit ported 90 plus days with device and carrier and timely redemption required. Virtual MasterCard typically takes 14 weeks. No cash access and expires in 6 months. Card issued by Sunrise Banks N.A. Member FDIC. Visit T-Mobile.com.
Nerds! Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Personal finance can feel like a pop quiz you didn't study for. This podcast is your study guide. On NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast, you'll hear from trusted journalists who explain the why behind major financial decisions. You'll get research-backed insights and clear pros and cons, whether you're planning a big purchase or just want to grow your wealth. Make your next financial move with confidence. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast on your favorite podcast app.
Lowe's, we're about to kick off something epic for fans who want more messy. And trust us, you'll want to be a rewards member when it happens. Join for free and get access to messy exclusives, surprises, and more. Head to lowes.com/moremessy. Now's the time to get in because members get more at Lowe's. Loyalty programs subject to terms and conditions. Visit lowes.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
You don't brag about your car's resale value until years later when it proves you made the right call. And Toyota makes that choice easy. For the sixth year in a row, Toyota was named the best resale value brand by Kelley Blue Book, with Camry, Tacoma, and 4Runner all earning best in class. Because when you buy a vehicle that's built to last, you drive away with value you can count on. Shop Toyota.com to learn more. Vehicles projected resale value and best resale value awards are specific to the 2026 model year. For more information, visit Kelley Blue Book's KBB.com. Toyota, let's go places.
This is the sound of captivity. This is the sound of rescue. And this is the sound of freedom. Give Armenia's captive bearers a second chance by supporting International Animal Rescue. Call 508-826-1083 or search The Great Bear Rescue to learn more.